also houses the Wendy and Emery Reeves collection. Wendy Russell Reeves was a leggy blonde from Marshall, Texas, who became a New York fashion model and the longtime lover of a wealthy European publisher, Emery Reeves, whom she finally married in 1964. She was the Jerry Hall, from Gonzales, Texas, of her day. Wendy became the chatelaine of a villa on the Côte d'Azur, formerly owned by Coco Chanel. Winston Churchill spent months at a time there to paint and to drink in Wendy's charms. His wife pointedly refused to join him. Noel Coward observed in his diary that Churchill was absolutely obsessed with Wendy Russell. I doubt if Churchill has ever been physically unfaithful, but oh, what has gone on inside that dynamic mind. After Emery died in 1981, Wendy offered to donate his $30 million collection of Impressionist and Post-Impressionist art to the New Dallas Museum, which was still in the planning stage. Museums in France and elsewhere avidly courted the widow, but they were unwilling to accommodate her intransigent demand that her residence be faithfully reproduced in order to showcase the art. Thus, one leans into the roped-off rooms in the DMA's version of a Mediterranean villa to see life as it was lived by a Hungarian playboy with his spirited Texas mistress. Here in their dining room, with still lifes by Courbet and Cézanne, are the Reeves' china plates and silverware all laid out on the immense banquet table. Housewares occupy center stage in this exhibit. The art is mere decor. A nude Degas pastel looms over the tiger-skin boudoir chairs in the master bedroom, and the bed itself is mounted on a kind of presentation dais. At the foot of the bed is a pair of Wendy's not exactly Cinderella-sized slippers. Stanley Marcus was the great level two proselytizer in Dallas. He was the only liberal and practically the only Democrat that I was aware of in the city when I was growing up. This was a city so hysterically anti-communist that the Dallas Symphony had to cancel a program of Shostakovich because he was Russian, and the park board ripped out a bed of poppies because they were red. Marcus fought against the absolutism and paranoia that dominated Dallas politics, creating space for ideas to breathe. Through Neiman Marcus, the marvelous department store that he oversaw, he tutored the newly affluent city, not only on how to dress and what to buy, but also how to behave. He raised the standard of cuisine in the city when he hired Helen Corbett to run the store's restaurant, the Zodiac Room. He almost single-handedly desegregated public facilities by welcoming black citizens to shop in the store and, in 1961, by serving two black couples in the Zodiac Room. The word went out in Dallas that desegregation had arrived. Marcus hired Eddie Bernice Johnson, a nurse, as an executive assistant on the singular condition that she run for office. In 1972, she was elected to the Texas legislature, the first black woman from Dallas ever elected to anything. Since 1993, she has served in the U.S. House of Representatives. Stanley Marcus changed Dallas. Few individuals have ever had such a profound and beneficent effect on the city in which they lived. Houston had its own great cultural modernizer in Dominique de Menil, the French heiress of the Schlumberger Oilfield Services Company. She and her husband, John, immigrated to Houston in 1941, following the Nazi occupation of Paris. They brought with them a sensibility that was practically unknown in Texas, intending to plant a flag of cosmopolitanism far from the volatile capitals of Europe. The de Menils collected more than 17,000 paintings and other works of art, centering on cubism, surrealism, pop, a totally alien aesthetic for the place and time. "What I admire, I must possess," Dominique once admitted. They brought artists and filmmakers such as Marcel Duchamp, Max Ernst, Roberto Rossellini, Michelangelo Antonioni, and Bernardo Bertolucci to speak and teach. They put a cowboy hat on René Magritte and took him to a rodeo. Dominique commissioned Renzo Piano to design a serene museum to house her vast art collection, his first American building. The museum is cool and gray and perfect. Nearby is the DeMille's most memorable contribution, the Rothko Chapel, a meditative space that provides a brooding counterpoint to the headstrong city. In front, there is a Barnett Newman sculpture, Broken Obelisk, which was intended to grace the Houston City Hall. But when the DeMille's insisted that it should be dedicated to the memory of Martin Luther King Jr., the city turned the gift down. Houston is a major philanthropy center, and they were the start of that. Tommy Napier, the assistant communications director of the Menil Collection, told me as he took Roberta and me through the DeMille's home, which is now used for museum events. Designed in 1950 by Philip Johnson, the house is a flat-roof, pale-brick, one-story affair, with a nearly windowless front, which some Houstonians initially mistook for a dentist's office. It was the first modern house in Houston, Napier said. Certainly, it provides a flagrant contrast to the antebellum-esque mansions of River Oaks. Across the back of the house is a long bank of windows, which in the Houston climate were fogged over like a shower stall. The furnishings, by the fashion designer Charles James, are riotously lush, not at all in keeping with the austere Johnson style. The dark living room has black Mexican floor tiles and a vivid yellow Rothko that nearly jumps off the charcoal gray wall. The bar is a kind of enlarged Joseph Cornell box, filled with colored highball glasses and stuffed birds on a shelf under a Matisse and a Max Ernst. There is a phone booth with a schoolteacher's pencil sharpener on a tiny desk, along with a Sunday missal and books of poetry by Anna Akhmatova. The door to Dominique's bedroom is covered with red velvet, and yet the room itself is like a cloister. The DeMille aesthetic is informed by a monkish devotion to simplicity and an absolute rapacity for beauty. The best museums in Texas are in Fort Worth. The Kimball, gracefully designed by Louis Kahn, his last and maybe finest work, using parallel concrete vaults that ingeniously reflect natural light, is one of the most acclaimed buildings of modern times. It set a standard for the future, which was matched by Taddeo Ando's exquisite modern art museum. The Amon Carter Museum of American Art, designed by Philip Johnson, houses a distinguished collection of Western art. These buildings showcase the artistry of Level 2 and its power to elevate a culture, and yet the walls are practically bare of any great Texas artist. There is a third level in my analysis, which is when a culture matures and, having absorbed the sophistication of Level 2, returns to its primitive origins to renew itself. One night recently in Houston, I had dinner with friends at 1/5, a new restaurant opened by Chris Shepard. He grew up in Tulsa and came to Houston to culinary school. Captivated by the diversity of cultural influences, he began prowling through the city markets and cafes, discovering a mix of cuisines that were all a part of the city around him. Shepard was drawn to what he called the underbelly of the vast city. Just driving west on Bel Air Boulevard is like taking a world tour through Central America, Thailand, Korea, and the Philippines. Suddenly the street signs are in Chinese characters. In 2011, Shepard opened a restaurant in a former lesbian nightclub that he calls Underbelly. He subtitled it The Story of Houston Food. The menu changes every day depending on what is available from the local farms, Vietnamese bakeries, the catch that day from the Gulf, and the whole animals that are brought to his in-house butchery. His wine list is annotated by the local rapper Bun B. He folds all these influences into a cuisine that reflects the city that Houston is now. I wanted to go from simple regional cooking to hyper-regional, Shepard told me. Shepard is a bear-sized man with bristling brown hair and an expression of intense concentration. His new restaurant, 1/5, reflects the restlessness and imagination that he brings to recreating a native cuisine. I wanted to do the corners of Texas, he said. You've got East Texas, which is Creole, with the field greens and okra. In West Texas, you have Hispanic influence in the chilies. North Texas, you had the cattle drives. In the South, in the Gulf, I wanted to give the sense of a true southern fishing camp. Then, in central Texas, you have the Czech and German influences. To accomplish all that, he decided he would reinvent the restaurant each year. Its current incarnation was a steakhouse. We had ordered the chef's board, which was brought to us by two waiters and stretched across the entire table. Crispy pork shoulder, lamb Wellington, brisket, collard greens and bacon, sweet potato au gratin. I have to say that my favorite part of the meal was dessert, apple pie, cooked in a wood-burning stove so that the crust was slightly charred but the apples were still firm. Transcendence is always rare, and the best examples of level three tend to be origin stories. Beyoncé's album Lemonade absorbed the street talk and country music in the church choir of St. John's United Methodist Church in Houston and enlarged the tablet of popular music. The National Wildfire Research Center in Austin quotes the limestone arches and tin roof barns of the countryside to create an environment that is both familiar and new. One can look at the jubilant choreography of Alvin Ailey's masterwork Revelations, for instance, which is a sumptuous recreation of Ailey's experiences in a Black Baptist church in the fly-speck Central Texas community of Rogers. It is as if the artist had split the atom of consciousness and released its energy into the universe. Robert Rauschenberg, who studied pharmacy at the University of Texas before discovering himself as an artist, used the images of his native Port Arthur, windmills, derricks, even a bubbling tub of oil-filled mud, to give a new language to modern art. He commented on the recession in Texas in the 1980s, caused by the crash in oil prices, to create what he called gluts, tire tracks, crumpled gas station logos, and highway signs riddled with bullet holes. The detritus of the car culture that rules and despoils America. I think of the gluts as souvenirs without nostalgia, Rauschenberg commented. This is what level three is all about, returning to one's roots with knowledge, self-confidence, and occasionally forgiveness. Periodically, Larry McMurtry erupts to deprecate the state of literature in Texas, which he has called disgracefully insular and uninformed, and produced by a pond full of self-satisfied frogs. He particularly singled out the overworked cowboy myth for undermining the literary project of the state before producing the best cowboy book ever, Lonesome Dove, 4 years later. In his essay, Ever a Bridegroom, published in the Texas Observer in 1981, he singled out only one writer in the entire state worthy of his unequivocal admiration, Vassar Miller, a little-known poet in Houston. McMurtry is one of my favorite writers, and after his article came out, I conceived what I thought was a hilarious idea. Every year, the Texas legislature selects a writer to be the poet laureate of the state. Typically, back in those days, an elderly schoolteacher from Port Arthur or Burke Burnett. I decided to start a political action committee and lobby legislators to pick a real poet for the post. Popac, I called it. Steve nominated Glenn Hardin, a talented poet known to be cantankerous and profane and certainly not in the mold of the usual laureate. Steve used to publish him in a poetry magazine he founded called Lucille. My object was to see how much money it would take to get my candidate accorded the state's highest literary position. Its only one, in fact. Just then, rather suspiciously in my opinion, the Texas Senate decided to formalize the selection process, sabotaging my scheme to bribe the legislators. Jack Ogg, a handsome senator from Houston, convened a panel proclaiming that its purpose was to select the next poet laureate of Texas. After that, every speaker who addressed the panel carefully spoke of laureates, not laureates. A few days after this perfunctory panel, the senators announced they had chosen a new poet laureate, Vassar Miller. This was the only time in Texas history that literary criticism has had an effect on state affairs. One book often nominated as a candidate for the Great Texas Novel was The Gay Place by Billy Lee Brammer. It's actually three novellas pressed together with a single towering figure, Governor Arthur Goddamn Fenstermaker, based on Brammer's real-life mentor, Lyndon Johnson. Billy Lee had worked for Johnson in Washington when he was Senate Majority Leader. Billy Lee had died of a methamphetamine overdose by the time I moved to Austin, so I never got to meet him. In the book, the only one he ever published, he captured a brief moment in Texas history in the late 1950s when liberals had a foothold in the Capitol and Austin was a highly sexed beatnik outpost. That hasn't entirely changed. It was the first novel to stake a claim on modern urban Texas. Billy Lee was unfortunately too chaotic to produce another book that might have secured his reputation as a true level 3 artist. I once had lunch with one of his ex-wives, Nadine Brammer, who remembered the time she took Billy Lee to a hypnotist to try to cure his smoking habit. As they were going up the elevator, she suggested that maybe Billy Lee should also try to get rid of his kleptomania. "No, I want to keep that," he said. Billy Lee wrote for the Texas Observer, the muck-raking liberal rag in Austin that had been home to Willie Morris, J. Frank Dobie, and a number of writers I admired. In 1971, I drove down to Austin from Dallas for an interview. Roberta and I had just returned to the United States from Egypt, where we had taught for 2 years at the American University in Cairo. We were living with my parents while I searched for a job. The Observer was a beacon for ambitious, smart-ass youngsters like me. It was co-edited by Molly Ivins and Kay Northcott. Molly was 6 feet tall, red-haired and big-boned. At her side was a black dog named Shit. Molly could spin out resonant Texas witticisms that became classics as soon as she uttered them. Jim Maddox, the attorney general, was so mean he wouldn't spit in your ear if your brains were on fire. Kay was Molly's physical opposite, diminutive with small, fine features and large scholarly eyeglasses. They were the Mutt and Jeff of Texas liberals, respected even by the politicians they lampooned, because the Observer made Texas politics into a recognizable genre, something to be savored. It set us apart. Perhaps because of Molly's continental education, the Observer began to resemble a left-wing French publication, with its satire and scathing exposés. We all became a little more Parisian, more amused by ourselves, and disdainful of newcomers who couldn't crack the code. I desperately wanted to be a part of the scene, but my interview with Molly went nowhere. I had no experience and nothing to show, so I drove back home, despairing of ever becoming a writer. Molly refined Texas stereotypes into an art form, like a Jewish comedian in the Catskills. Her 1991 collection of columns spent 29 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, making her a national celebrity at the same moment that Ann Richards got elected as governor. They were lashed together in the public imagination, the pair of them defining a particular kind of Texas woman, earthy, progressive, sharp-tongued, and unafraid of men, no matter how big their belt buckles. McMurtry hasn't delivered another broadside on the current state of Texas letters, so I asked Steve what he thought. The state of Texas literature is defined by writers worrying about the state of Texas literature, he said grumpily. Why is everyone in Texas so anxious about defining a regional literature when nobody else feels the need to do that? Anything you say reinforces the provincialism. Just let it be what it will be. After I had been writing in Texas for several years, I was nominated to be a member of the Texas Institute of Letters. All the best people were in it, I was told, and so I naturally wanted to be one of them. But the friend who had submitted my name reported that I had been rejected, at least at that time. When my name came up, one of the board members advised, "Let him spend another year on the cross." I had been a small part of a very minor literary scene when we lived in Atlanta. Nothing so formal as the TIL. We were all regional writers, and whoever had a single nostril above the waterline of total obscurity was regarded with reverence and green-eyed jealousy. When my first book, City Children, Country Summer, came out in 1979, an autograph party was held for me at the old New York bookshop on Piedmont Road, which was the unofficial hangout for the Atlanta literati. My book was about minority children from New York City, mainly black and Hispanic kids from Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant, who spent part of a summer with Amish and Mennonite dairy farmers in central Pennsylvania. The venerable charity that sponsors the program is the Fresh Air Fund. The book got no notice at all, followed by zero sales. It was appropriate that the party took place in an antiquarian bookstore because mine was a rare book from the moment it came off the press. A friend of mine aptly described the publication experience as the calm before the calm. But I was a published author at last. A well-known Atlanta writer, Marshall Frady, who had just published a best-selling biography of Billy Graham, was my host and sponsor. Like most Southern writers I knew, Marshall was addicted to the bon mot. When we arrived at the party, he told Roberta, "You look positively lambent tonight," a cherished compliment she's never forgotten. The party itself was memorable mainly because the police arrived with reports of an attempted homicide. The victim was a drunken lout, likely a poet, who had been amusing himself by pouring cheap champagne down ladies' dresses. Marshall took him outside and administered some rough justice. "A mere schoolyard scuffle, officers," he said, when the black and white pulled up, although Marshall had actually broken his own hand during his inexpert pummeling. Imagine what the cops thought when they learned they had stumbled upon an autograph party for a book about the Amish. When it came to pass that the golden gates to the Texas Institute of Letters finally opened, I could see what McMurtry was complaining about, although he didn't have Georgia as a point of comparison. McMurtry himself was the speaker at one of the first meetings I attended. He complained about the burdens of fame, eliciting little sympathy. At that same event, I also met Cormac McCarthy, a laconic Tennessean who was living in El Paso at the time and therefore qualified as Texan. He had already published Sutri and Blood Meridian, but I had not yet read him. None of his books had sold more than 5,000 copies, despite impressive reviews. He didn't even have an agent. When we were sitting on the carpet of the hospitality suite with a bottle of bourbon between us, I asked how he was able to make a living. "I've always been fortunate in that people have given me quite a lot of money," he said. He first became aware of his good fortune when he was living in a barn, surviving on cornbread, and didn't have enough money to buy toothpaste. One day, he went to look in the mailbox and found a complimentary tube of Pepsodent. A few days later, a man came to the barn and gave me a check for $20,000 from a foundation I had never heard of, he said. And only recently, he remarked, he had become a MacArthur Fellow. He really was a very lucky guy. Sitting in an easy chair in that cramped hotel suite was the grand old man of Texas Letters, John Graves, who wrote an extraordinary book, Goodbye to a River, in 1960. The river in question, the Brazos, runs from the High Plains to the Gulf of Mexico, serving as the unofficial border between East and West Texas. The Spanish named it Los Brazos de Dios, the Arms of God. Upon learning of plans to erect 5 dams along the Brazos, creating a string of reservoirs, John decided to travel by canoe down a twisty portion of the river in what he thought would be a fruitless protest. As he wrote, "In a region like the Southwest, scorched to begin with, alternating between floods and droughts, its absorbent cities quadrupling their censuses every few years, electrical power and flood control and moisture conservation and water skiing are praiseworthy projects. More than that, they are essential. We river-minded ones can't say much against them, nor probably should we want to, nor mostly do we. But if you are built like me, neither the certainty of change nor the need for it, nor any wry philosophy will keep you from feeling a certain enraged awe when you hear that a river that you've known always, and that all men of that place have known always back into the red dawn of men, will shortly not exist, a piece of river, anyhow, my piece." McMurtry had summed John up as neither journalist nor novelist, but ruminator. He was an ex-Marine with a glass eye, the memento of a Japanese grenade on Saipan. He had grown up in Fort Worth and on his grandfather's ranch in South Texas, but like most of us with any literary pretensions, he had fled to where the writers and readers were, to New York, where he got a master's degree in English, then to Europe, where he bummed around, aping Hemingway. It's heartening to think that he might once have been as uncertain as the rest of us, Steve said when he gave John's eulogy in 2013. That his majestic self-possession was something he had to earn and grow into. John returned to Texas in 1957 to take care of his dying father. It was in Texas that he finally found his voice, his last editor, Ann Close, who also edited this book, observed. We were all mystified by him. His prose was incantatory, and his attachment to the place we lived in was so much keener and more revelatory than ours. He used the money from Goodbye to a River to buy 400 thin-soiled acres in Glen Rose, 50-something miles southwest of Fort Worth, that he aptly named Hard Scrabble. After that, he just seemed to disappear into the land. He wrote occasional essays that were collected and admired. He often showed up at literary events where he was genial and not superior, despite the reverence that always attended him. He wore heavy horn rims that were purposely positioned halfway down his nose so he could tilt his head down and peer over the frames with his one good eye. The other one tended to wander, as he did while Cormac and I chatted at his feet with his divided glance. I always had to remind myself which eye to respond to. He always seemed to be more like a fan or a contented spouse, never invoking the authority he had over us, preferring to listen. You always felt that in some quiet way he was measuring you and recording your worth, Steve observed. Perhaps his failure as a novelist kept him from venturing more deeply into the craft. Maybe he thought he could never match that first book, so why try? Maybe he didn't care enough about his gift, even though those of us who admired him would often dip into his book for inspiration when our own words refused to flow and his seemed to come so effortlessly. Steve ended his eulogy by quoting John's own report of encountering Hemingway in Pamplona during the San Fermín Festival, surrounded by acolytes, holding court at a sidewalk cafe in the main square, using his sport coat as a cape, while still another collegiate American served his bull and charged him. John held back. I had not yet proved myself as a writer, a real one, he wrote. And until I managed that, I didn't feel I had the right to impose myself on established authors, however much I might admire their work. It's an introduction long overdue, Steve concluded. Mr. Hemingway, meet Mr. Graves. According to the legends we tell ourselves, Texans get ahead by relying on luck, nerve, and instinct. These are good qualities. They might be sufficient in a culture of wildcatters and poker players, but not for engineers or city planners or educators, the kinds of people who actually build urban civilizations. But cities don't fit comfortably into the Texas myth. Central to this myth is bigness. I'm not talking just about the drive from Beaumont to El Paso. Texans themselves are supposed to be big people. I recall the 1960 Boy Scout Jamboree. I went there with a delegation of scouts from Dallas. Along with us came Big Tex, the 50-foot-tall fiberglass statue that stood outside the State Fair in Dallas, or I should say Big D. Big Tex loomed over our tent city, and all of us, I believe, felt proud to be singled out and set apart from the scouts from other states and countries. Somehow we participated in his bigness. Texas is a macho state. We love sports. We call our teams Cowboys and Rangers and Mavericks and Rockets and Oilers and Spurs. There are no Blue Jays or Dolphins playing ball in Texas. The downside of the machismo is that we turn away from the feminine side of our nature. It is evident in the indifference to beauty and a sort of loathing for compassion, as manifested in our schools, our prisons, our mental health facilities, and our lack of concern for the environment. I recall the panic that hit the Texas legislature in the 1980s when a bill was put forth to ornament our license plates with wildflowers. What could be more representative of our state than our native bluebonnets and primroses? But that proposal was buried as lawmakers turned to the important business of trying to get beef declared the official meat of the Olympics. Hollywood adored the Texas myth. On the silver screen, Texas was not a real place. It was a symbol for the unbridled West, a playground for the frontier legend, made over and over again in the epic westerns of John Ford, William Wyler, and Howard Hawks. Texas was an arena of the soul, where a man comes face to face with death and destiny. It occupies the same emotional territory as the wilderness of Judea, only without God. When we're in Texas, the actual film may be shot in Monument Valley, Utah, Stagecoach, The Searchers, or in the rolling Canadian wheat fields, Days of Heaven. There's a forgettable thriller called The Swarm, in which a train crosses a range of mountains to enter the coastal city of Houston. Even in The Alamo, the archetypal Texas movie, San Antonio is set on the banks of the Rio Grande, which in fact is 200 miles south. Seeing these movies made me feel special as a Texan, but in a fraudulent sort of way. I imagine that every Texas man of my age has experienced the dissonance of failing to live up to the legend in people's minds. Once when I was teaching in Egypt, I went horseback riding in the desert near the pyramids. When the owner of the stables learned where I was from, he exclaimed, "Oh, Texas, have we got a horse for you?" Three handlers led out a rearing stallion with pulsating nostrils who pawed the air as if he could rip it apart. He hadn't been ridden in 2 years. I was no John Wayne, but to save face, I mounted this brute who rocketed past the Sphinx and took me halfway to Libya before I could coax him to turn around. The Kennedy assassination put an end to the era of heroic Texas movies. After that, the state represented everything Hollywood thought was vile and wrong with America. Texas was Slim Pickens as Major King Kong, riding the hydrogen bomb to apocalypse in Dr. Strangelove, wickedly written by Texas native Terry Southern. Now Texas was an asylum of rednecks, yahoos, drifters, and chainsaw massacrers. The Texas I actually lived in finally did break into the movies, first with HUD, based on McMurtry's first novel, Horsemen Pass By. The book was about the end of the Western frontier and the men who made it. The movie, with Paul Newman in the rapscallion title role, made the anti-mythic story into a legend of its own. A few years later, there was a terrific film called Midnight Cowboy, which opens on the Big Tex Drive-In in Big Spring. The hero, Joe Buck, John Voight, works as a dishwasher, but he has a poster of Newman and HUD on his wall. Joe Buck tries to live out the myth by dressing up in movie cowboy clothes and seeking stardom in New York, where he becomes a failed gigolo. I was teaching in Cairo when the movie came out, and one night during Ramadan, I took my class to see it after the evening meal. To me, Midnight Cowboy was about the neurosis of wanting to live up to a myth. I came out of the film exhilarated, but my students were shaken. For the first time, I realized how much the rest of the world valued Texas, what a rich legacy it is, and how universally appealing the myth is. Perhaps Texas really is a place that exists more fully in film than in real life. The fear besetting Texans, including its writers and filmmakers, was that by leaving the myth behind, Texas would be crushed by ordinariness. And yet, it's exactly that quotidian quality of life in the small towns and featureless suburbs that becomes so luminous and heartbreaking in the plays and films of Horton Foote, such as Tender Mercies and The Trip to Bountiful. It also awakens the comedy of Mike Judge's animated series King of the Hill and his cult classic movie of the corporate software culture in Austin, Office Space. Richard Linklater became the chronicler of the ongoing dialectic of the Austin streets with his first commercial movie, Slacker, 1991, and then in Dazed and Confused, Waking Life, and many other independent films. His tour de force, Boyhood, follows a child who actually grows up in Texas during the 12 years it took Rick to make the film, tracing the evolution of the boy's consciousness as he approaches maturity. The myth has diminished, assuming a more modest place in the Texas psyche. It may never disappear entirely, nor would I wish it to. The myth has gone through hard times before and come back to life, although each time I think with a little less reality. The danger in holding on to a myth is that it becomes like a religion we've stopped believing in. It no longer instructs us. It only stultifies us. And besides, what do we want with a myth that makes us into people we don't want to be? Level 3 requires shaking off the mythic illusions and telling new stories about who we really are. The noble quality of Level 3 is that it returns us to the familiar. The songs we heard as children, the sounds of our labor, the primal smells of the kitchen, the legends of our ancestors, the phrases and intonations we cling to in our language, the colors of our land, the cloud shapes in our sky, all are folded into the art of Level 3. It feels like home. And isn't that the point of culture? To come home again with a clear and educated eye? Chapter 5. The Cradle of Presidents. The LBJ Ranch is now a national park, and one early summer day, as I was driving west, I decided to stop in. The bluebonnets and Indian blankets along the roadsides had faded, replaced by purple thistles and Mexican hats. Lyndon Johnson used to race down these narrow roads in his Lincoln convertible, with a scotch and soda in hand, terrifying visiting heads of state as he careened into the curves. The Lincoln was equipped with a special lever-action horn that bellowed like a rutting bull in order to capture the attention of the heifers in the pasture. Johnson would be trailed by a station wagon full of Secret Service agents, and periodically he would slow down and rattle the ice in his styrofoam cup outside his window until an agent dashed over and refilled his drink. Johnson was the only president I can recall who really loved cars, especially convertibles. There's a little museum at the end of the airstrip housing a 1934 Ford Phaeton, which he outfitted with a gun rack and a wet bar, the Corvette he gave his daughter Lucy for her 18th birthday, an antique fire truck, and a little blue amphicar, a chimerical cross between an automobile and a boat, which Johnson bought as a practical joke. He would drive his guests down to the banks of the Pedernales River and pretend that his brakes had failed as he plunged the vehicle into the water. There's a one-room schoolhouse where Johnson signed the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, one of the pillars of the Great Society, and beyond that a walled cemetery shaded by massive live oaks where Lyndon and Lady Bird rest. Finally, there is the house itself, made of limestone, with a broad veranda overlooking the sweep down to the river, handsome but not majestic, the home of a Texas squire on a working ranch, with cow patties decorating the lawn. The last thing Lyndon liked to do at night was to stand on his porch, look at the stars, and pee. On the wall beside Johnson's desk are portraits of his two beagles, him and her, commissioned by Barbara Streisand. In the easy chair is a pillow embroidered with the sentiment, "This is my ranch, and I do as I damn please." The living room has a bank of three television sets, one for each of the networks that existed during his presidency, and a domino table where he liked to play 42. The kitchen floor is yellow linoleum. There's a copy of The Joy of Cooking on a shelf. On the back porch are a massive freezer and a beer tap. It was in the small den under the stairs that the staff gathered on November 22, 1963, to be told by the Secret Service, "You are now in the house of the President of the United States." They had been busy preparing for the reception that night for John F. Kennedy. Lyndon Johnson was Kennedy's opposite in so many ways. Where Kennedy was polished, Johnson was vulgar, fantastically and unselfconsciously so, picking his nose, scratching his ass, eating off other people's plates. He once held a staff meeting in his bedroom while he was getting an enema. Kennedy went to Harvard. He had a Pulitzer Prize, and his friends were movie stars. Johnson went to a teacher's college in San Marcos. Kennedy was beautiful, and Johnson was ungainly, with immense features, his nose, his ears, and his cock, which he named Jumbo. Kennedy seemed to be a liberal because of his background in rhetoric, but in fact he was a business-oriented conservative and a cold warrior. He expanded defense spending by 20%. Among his accomplishments were the creation of the Peace Corps, a tax cut, and a nuclear test ban treaty. But his most enduring legacy was the Vietnam War. Kennedy was the kind of president people would have expected a Texan to be. Johnson, despite his retrograde political past, became the most progressive president since Franklin Roosevelt. And yet the Kennedy acolytes in the Eastern establishment sneered at him. "The greatest bigots in the world are the Democrats on the east side of New York," Johnson complained. The liberal tradition that Johnson embodied is practically extinct in Texas now. But so much of the country we live in was fashioned by his administration, including Medicaid, Medicare, the Civil Rights Act, public broadcasting, federal aid to the arts and education, the War on Poverty, the Immigration and Nationality Act, the Voting Rights Act, even the Gun Control Act. Kennedy had neither the mandate nor the skill to enact such a transformative agenda. Despite these accomplishments, Johnson's presidency sank under the weight of the war. The Kennedy men in Johnson's cabinet told him the only way out was forward, and Johnson was too cowed by their intellect to change course. His resentment against the Harvards and the Eastern establishment socialites would sometimes flare up with a startling bitterness. After Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, an aide warned him that black protesters in Washington might march on Georgetown and burn it down. "I've waited 35 years for this day," Johnson said. Texans agonized through the Johnson presidency, sharing in his humiliation, but also enduring the mortification of his hillbilly manners and cornpone accent. The hatred heaped upon him splattered over the rest of us. LBJ was the lens through which we were viewed. And to be fair, Texans were as resentful of the Eastern establishment as it was of us. It's a cultural divide in this country that has never been bridged. LBJ was hounded out of office by young people, including me, who protested the war, but also hated who he was and where he came from. I wouldn't change my opposition to that war, but I wish we had been kinder to him. When Steve's novel, The Gates of the Alamo, came out, there was a dinner for him at the LBJ Library. He and I were seated on either side of Lady Bird as George Christian, who was Johnson's press secretary, recalled the trip LBJ had made to Korea. Johnson told the American troops stationed there that his great-grandfather had died at the Alamo. Christian was half asleep in the back of the room, but when he heard LBJ say that, he sat bolt upright. A Texan making such a claim is a bit like a Muslim saying he is descended from the Prophet Muhammad. "There were only three reporters there, and none of them seemed to take notice," Christian said. He was relieved that the president had gotten away with a whopping lie. But one of the radio reporters, Sid Davis, had recorded the speech, and he played it for the press pool, which included several Texans. They all knew the truth. Christian went to Lyndon and said he was in hot water because he had claimed his ancestor died at the Alamo.
"I never said any such thing," Johnson replied. "Well, sir, I heard you." "I don't care what you heard, I didn't say it."
"But Sid Davis recorded it."
"I don't care what he recorded. My great-grandfather didn't die at the Alamo," the president said.
The Alamo story hit the press, and it became a great embarrassment for Johnson, especially in Texas. At another event a few months later, when the controversy was still raging, Johnson complained that he had never gotten to finish the story. His great-grandfather didn't die at the Alamo. He died at the Alamo Hotel in Eagle Pass. All through the telling of the anecdote, Lady Bird chuckled. By that time, she had been a widow for nearly 30 years. Like Lyndon, Lady Bird suffered in comparison to her glamorous predecessor. Jackie was the most famous woman in the world, chic, beautiful, and iconic in her grief, whereas Lady Bird was a little brown wren, as her daughter Linda once described her. As First Lady, she was best known for promoting the Highway Beautification Act, derided as Lady Bird's bill by opponents, but it was just one of 200 laws concerning conservation and the environment that have her stamp on them. Because of her, the plague of billboards that infested our roadways was sharply diminished, and junkyards were removed or screened off. It was her noble goal to let nature shine through. In Austin, Lady Bird was the driving force in creating the hike and bike trail around what is now called Lady Bird Lake, a body of water that was itself created by Lyndon as a young congressman when he succeeded in getting the federal government to dam the Colorado River and bring power to the Hill Country. The trail now functions as a kind of town square for fitness enthusiasts. Lady Bird had been inspired by a trip to London, where she admired the walking path beside the Thames. In the 1980s and 1990s, you would often see her on the trail, wearing her bonnet, discreetly followed by her Secret Service bodyguard. Lady Bird founded the National Wildflower Research Center, now also renamed after her, in Austin in 1982, on her 70th birthday. And it's largely because of her that the roadsides of Texas are so brilliantly carpeted. My father served as head of the Beautify Texas Council in the 1980s, and he worked with Lady Bird. After he passed away, I found a letter from her thanking him for the seeds for the hike and bike trail. I had run around that trail thousands of times and never known about that connection. When the research center opened, wildflowers were still so uncultivated that they were difficult to propagate. Lady Bird herself would prowl the state scouting for hardy specimens. One particularly dry spring, she came upon a hillside in central Texas that was spilling over with pink evening primrose, which she describes in her book with Carlton B. Lee's Wildflowers Across America as the most exquisite and feminine of all wildflowers. A young man was plowing them under. Imagine how startled he must have been to see the former first lady throw herself in front of his tractor and yell, "Stop!" She rented the pasture until the flowers went to seed so she could harvest them. She was the most self-deprecating woman in public life I ever knew. Once I was at a party in honor of Shakespeare's birthday, given by her erudite nephew, author Philip Bobbitt, who is a law professor at the University of Texas. Lady Bird and I were seated together at dinner, and she asked me to pass the salt, which was in front of her. She was then nearly 90 and suffering from macular degeneration. The only way she could still enjoy her beloved wildflowers was by examining them with a magnifying glass. But she was game and even bemused by her condition. "Just now, during cocktails in the music room, I was trying to carry on a conversation with this gentleman," she told me. "He was so unresponsive, although I was being my most charming self. Finally, I realized I was speaking to a bust of Shakespeare." Past Johnson City, you're in the German part of the state, with sturdy stone cottages surrounded by peach orchards and vineyards. Franciscan friars began producing wine in Texas in the 1650s. In the late 19th century, when aphids wiped out French vineyards, it was rootstock from Texas vines that rescued the industry. History-minded Texans look upon French wines as Texas wines with French labels on them. Outside of Ozona, the interstate was lined with a vivid, low-lying flower called a mountain pink. Another of Lady Bird's favorites, not just for its color, but because it grows in the most obdurate conditions, such as roadside gravel. I felt as if I were driving through one of those early super-saturated Technicolor movies. I turned north at Iran, named after Ira and Ann Yates, who owned the ranch where one of the great Texas oil booms played out. Once you cross the Pecos River, pump jacks and windmills stretch to the horizon. In 2004, someone quietly began acquiring ranches in West Texas, near Van Horn, using shell corporations to hide his identity. The fact that anybody was buying up land in Van Horn was a little puzzling, especially at the prices offered. Parched, scalped, remote, the land is certainly not prime real estate. Moreover, the state was in the middle of a punishing drought. The mystery buyer soon became one of the largest landholders in the state. But the question wasn't so much the who as the why. Finally, in 2005, Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon and one of the wealthiest men in the world, admitted to being the purchaser. He needed the land, nearly 300,000 acres by then, with more to come, to build a launching pad for rockets into space. He had become infatuated with space travel when his family moved to Houston in the 1960s, during the NASA glory era, a time when Houston called itself Space City, USA. "For me, space is something I've been in love with since I was 5 years old," Bezos told the Washington Post after he purchased the paper in 2013. "I watched Neil Armstrong step onto the surface of the moon, and I guess it imprinted me." Bezos's space company, Blue Origin, launched its first rocket from West Texas in 2011. That one crashed, but in September 2015, the company not only sent a rocket into space, but managed to retrieve it in a historic vertical landing at the Van Horn facility. Bezos expects to send test passengers into space soon. "The vision for Blue is pretty simple. We want to see millions of people living and working in space," he said after the successful launch. "Do we want to go to Mars? Absolutely, but we want to go everywhere." Meantime, Elon Musk, the PayPal co-founder and the creator of Tesla, the electric automobile, has a rocket test facility near Waco and is building his own launching site for an astronomical venture, SpaceX, on the Texas Gulf Coast near Brownsville. The Texas skies will soon be jammed with rockets. In most of West Texas, there is really nowhere to look except up. In the hills near Fort Davis is the McDonald Observatory, where Roberta and I once got to see the rings of Saturn and somewhere far back in time, a white dwarf. Amateur astronomers settle out here in ranchettes and build their own backyard observatories with retractable roofs. Living in West Texas is like being close to the ocean, with the sky serving as a natural point of focus for the contemplation of eternity. On the side of I-40, you come upon Cadillac Ranch, 10 vintage graffiti-covered caddies buried nose down in the dirt, tail fins to the sky. It is certainly the most famous art installation in the state. Stanley Marsh III, an art supporter and prankster, commissioned the work in 1974. He also liked to put up phony traffic signs, such as "Road does not end" and "You will never be the same." Like a lot of rich Texas eccentrics, he kept exotic animals, a lion, a zebra, a camel, etc. When a developer threatened to build a suburb next to Marsh's property, Stanley erected a billboard on his property line saying, "Future home of the world's largest poisonous snake farm." Just south of Amarillo is Palo Duro Canyon, a red gash in the landscape 1,000 feet deep and 120 miles long, ranging from half a mile to 20 miles in width. Only the Grand Canyon is larger. Palo Duro was the heart of the Comancheria, the last band of Southern Plains Indians who refused to submit to the dominion of the white colonizers gathered there in what they believed was a divinely protected space. In 1874, a group of troopers from the 4th U.S. Cavalry crept into the sanctuary, catching the Indians by surprise. The Indians, Comanches, Kiowas, and Cheyennes, fled on foot. They were not pursued. Instead, the soldiers rounded up the Indians' horses and led them to slaughter, the defining moment at which the Texas frontier finally came to an end. The following year, the Comanche leader, Quanah Parker, surrendered the remnants of his depleted, starving band at Fort Sill. In 1878, Parker was permitted to lead a small group of Indians off the reservation in Oklahoma in order to go on what would be their last buffalo hunt in Palo Duro. The land was then owned by Charles Goodnight, the most famous rancher in Texas history. The thought that the vast canyon could belong to a single man was hard for the Indians to comprehend. In a journey of about 200 miles, they hadn't seen a single buffalo. Only then did they realize how thoroughly their way of life had been vanquished. Evidently, their plight made an impression on Goodnight. He found a few stray buffalo and began breeding his own herd. They were practically the only remaining animals from the millions that once thundered across the plains. In December 1916, Goodnight invited another group of Indians to return to the canyon for what he billed as the last buffalo hunt. For the occasion, he started his own film company. He wanted to chronicle the Old West as he remembered it for the first generation that would know it only from the movies. In the silent film, Goodnight's herd is seen galloping over the rim of the canyon into a narrow defile, followed by a group of Kiowa braves in feathered headdresses, old men plump from the idle confinement of the reservation. A single buffalo is cut away from the herd and quickly surrounded by circling braves who lean toward the animal as they discharge their arrows. The buffalo's knees buckle as he takes a few final steps. Then the film cuts to the Indians dancing around the dead animal, drinking cups of warm blood as its hide is being cut away. It was the last buffalo they would ever kill. Goodnight's film also chronicles the end of another era, his own. Like a number of other independent cattlemen, Goodnight had assembled his first herd by rounding up stray longhorns, feral descendants of the animals brought by the Spanish conquistadors. In the economic desperation following the Civil War, longhorn cattle were selling for about $2 a head in Texas, but they would bring as much as $40 in the stockyards of Chicago. The cowboy heyday began in 1867, when a herd of 2,400 steers was driven from San Antonio to the railhead in Abilene, Kansas, along what became known as the Chisholm Trail. Goodnight and his friend Oliver Loving pioneered another trail to Denver. Their relationship was the model for Larry McMurtry's classic bromance, Lonesome Dove. The cowboy era essentially came to an end in 1885, when barbed wire fenced off the plains. In that meager span of 18 years, 5 million cattle and 1 million mustangs, along with uncounted numbers of hogs and other livestock, were taken to market. Great fortune sprang up in a state that had, until then, relied upon little more than subsistence farming. But most enduringly, a myth was born that continues to define Texas in the minds of people all over the world, and especially in the state itself. Style is the most obvious legacy of the cowboy legend, the boots, which kept the cowboy's legs from chafing. The denim jeans that provided some protection against the constant brush of sharp grasses and thorny mesquite, and the broad-brimmed hat to shield against the sun, modest working clothes that made perfect sense for a man riding the range in 1875, but that continued to be the ensemble of choice for so many Texans whose lives are largely lived indoors. Press the jeans and add a crisp white shirt with pearl snap buttons, and you've got an Austin real estate developer. The cowboy style is an implicit pledge of allegiance to the mentality the myth embodies, which can be denominated as rugged individualism. The world is full of danger, and the cowboy has to be ready to defend himself and his family. In place of the law, the cowboy lives by a code of fairness and rough justice. He doesn't impose his will on others, and he bridles at the suggestion that anyone, especially government, has a right to tell him what to do. God and nature are forceful presences in the cowboy's life, although his stark and unforgiving circumstances, combined with endless spans of boredom, give rise to stoic bouts of existential despair. Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings sang a memorable duet, "Mamas, Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys," which speaks to the solitary blankness of such a life. Cowboys ain't easy to love, and they're harder to hold. They'd rather give you a song than diamonds or gold. Lone Star belt buckles and old faded Levi's, and each night begins a new day. If you don't understand him and he don't die young, he'll probably just ride away. In 1948, George H.W. Bush, a decorated naval aviator during the Second World War, a graduate of Yale, son of a future U.S. senator from Connecticut, and an aspiring young oil man, moved his family to a little duplex on a dirt road in Odessa. It was hot, dry, flat as a tortilla, and 350 miles from the nearest airport in Dallas. They shared a bathroom with two prostitutes, a mother-daughter combo, and often got locked out of the toilet by thoughtless clients.
In 1950, the Bushes and their two children at the time, George W. and Robin, moved to Midland, a larger city 20 miles down the road, which was the headquarters of nearly every independent oil man in Texas. It is called Midland because it is halfway between Fort Worth and El Paso. The Bushes purchased a 3-bedroom frame house on West Ohio Avenue. We like to say that we're the only presidential house that was home to two presidents, two governors, and a first lady.